wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
The following KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Underground Graduate School. Portland Underground Graduate School creates racial, lifelong learning opportunities that work for everyone's real lives. For more information, please visit www.pugspdx.com. And good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener and supporting a democratically run radio station. Welcome to the OMO Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is engineering. The OMO is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromise news media. Today in our program, Clayton Morgan shares with us some thoughts in a piece he calls Civilization and Our Discontents. Desiree Hellinger speaks with canoe families and kayak activists who were in Seattle on May 20th for an Indigenous-led day of resistance to the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline. I will close out the program with a reading. The article is entitled, The Need to Work Less is a Matter of Life and Death, by David Spencer. Leading off our program today, Bill Resnick interviews Carolina Ureta and Tony DeFalco of the organization Verde that is working in the Cully neighborhood, organizing the community to increase affordable housing, stop displacement, and make Cully a model in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and stop global warming. Bill?
Hi, Tony DeFalco and Carolina Ureta. Welcome to KBOO. Huh.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, thanks.
Tony and Carolina work at Verde, which is an important member of the group now gathering signatures for a Portland City initiative to establish a Portland Clean Energy Fund. So, Carolina and Tony, why don't you introduce yourself, introduce Verde, and introduce the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having us on. It's a pleasure to be here. As Bill said, my name is Tony DeFalco, and I'm the deputy director at Verde. And Verde is a nonprofit based in Northeast Portland. We've been around for about 15 years. And our goal is to build environmental wealth in communities. And what we mean by that is the opportunity to create jobs in the environmental sector, to have some of the environmental goodies like solar panels, bike lanes, parks in neighborhoods that are populated by low-income people and people of color, and to create more opportunities for community members to have stewardship over those resources. We also lead Living Cully, which is an effort to to reinterpret sustainability as an anti-poverty strategy, which involves focusing on housing, transportation, community organizing, and green infrastructure in the Cully neighborhood in Portland.
You're even building housing, aren't you?
Yes.
You're working with a mobile home development. You've got all sorts of housing.
The Living Cully initiative is really exciting because it puts people of color and low-income people in the driver's seat of how they want their neighborhood to change and to become a place that is very livable, but also a place that remains affordable so that you have these improvements in mobile home parks all throughout the neighborhood that people can stay in, people that live there now, rather than being forced out as the neighborhood improves.
That is your anti-displacement strategy.
That's right.
Is the word, I guess. Carolina, you're part of the environmental sustainability as a poverty program. Why don't you explain what do you do at Verde?
So my name's Carolina Ireta Gonzalez, and I'm the community energy advocate with Verde. That means that we're looking to identify energy projects that either generate energy or conserve energy in the neighborhood and benefit the residents within the Cully neighborhood. So really looking for the way that these projects benefit low-income communities and communities of color here in Portland.
Tell us about the initiative. You're really involved in the Portland Clean Energy Fund, the initiative to create the fund. Tell us about the initiative, and then we can talk about its components and how they would be really great for Cully residents and, in fact, the whole planet.
Yes. So Verde is one of the lead organizations, along with a group of community of color organizations here in the city of Portland, leading the Portland Clean Energy Fund. This would create a 1% business license surcharge on large retail businesses. That means businesses that make over $1 billion nationally and $500 million locally. And this would create a pot of money that would then be available for nonprofit organizations to apply to do green energy projects here locally within the city of Portland. It would also provide opportunities for job training and contracting, and it would greatly benefit a lot of low-income residents and communities of color here in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Greatly benefit in so many ways. One of them is the jobs that it creates, and the other one is clean air and water and housing stability. Tell us about the energy part in specific, the kinds of things that you're looking to do, and community energy in specific.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit more about the work that I do. So like I said, we're at Verde trying to identify energy projects that we can move forward in the neighborhood. And we actually spent last year developing a neighborhood scale energy plan called the Living Kali Community Energy Plan. And this identifies both renewable energy pilots within the neighborhood and energy conservation efforts. And we definitely are looking for pilots that support affordable housing. And so one of the challenges now that we have these pilots is identifying the funds that are available to actually develop these projects. And so the Portland Clean Energy Fund would make funds available so that communities could develop, for example, a solar array on a community institution.
Like the St. Charles Church.
Yes, that's one of our projects.
Yeah. You know, your plan is great. People should look at it the web. How do they get to it?
I think the simplest way to get to the Living Kali Community Energy Plan is to go to the livingkali.org website, and there you can find like the little box that says what do we do, and there's a section that says Living Kali Community Energy, and if you follow that link, you'll get to the plan.
You get to the plan. The plan is really interesting and attractive.
And I wanted to say, like, you know, we're one of the projects that we're looking to develop is a solar array on top of the St. Charles Church, which is a community institution in Kali and really supports our community organizing within the neighborhood. It supports our anti-displacement efforts. It provides a lot of services to low-income members within the neighborhood and the greater city of Portland. And so putting a solar array, and we're looking to actually put storage on this site too, would help offset the church's utility bills. And if we get storage on there, it would also serve as a resiliency center within the neighborhood, meaning that if there was ever some type of power outage within the neighborhood, within the city of Portland that lasted a long time, St. Charles would still be able to generate electricity and people would be able to go there to, you know, plug in their cell phones or their laptops. They're planning on continuing to run electricity for the kitchen, so people would be able to store medicine and food on site. So it's a really great project. The challenge being the funding. There aren't a lot of funding streams for community-driven initiatives like these.
Yeah, and there are so many possibilities in Kali. How many people live in the Kali neighborhood?
13,300 people.
13,000. You're a large village, actually. Yeah. And in some ways, you are a village since you're sort of, you're really in the city, but you're sort of isolated from the city, too, by Columbia Boulevard. A great deal of the acreage of Kali is that industrial district. Mm-hmm. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Tony DeFalco and Carolina Irada. We're talking about the Verde project that is really reconstructing, has at least the possibilities of reconstructing the Cully neighborhood There are so many wonderful possibilities, and we were talking particularly about, well, there's housing displacement that they're dealing with. They're building housing. It's an amazing project, actually. If it was in every community in Portland, you would see, and they were as successful as you, it seems to me we could be dealing with the climate crisis and the jobs crisis. Both would be, in fact, solved, at least in Portland. But it does take funds and finances to both build the low-income housing and affordable housing, to rehabilitate housing. It also takes funds to build the parks and the bikeways and things so people aren't using their car all the time and the rest of it, and have much healthier lifestyles. And, of course, it takes some amount of money to build the energy stuff, which I'd like to get into a little bit more right now. It seems to me the solar revolution is on in the world and in the United States, and the fossil fuel companies. Coal is dead and will be finished and when we can force the investor-owned utilities to shutter their plants. They want to just keep running them until the cost of repairing them is greater than the cost of moving towards other energy supplies. But that has to be stopped, and as well as the Chinese are, to some extent, trying to cut their coal plants, and the rest of the world has to, too. In any event, though, the energy revolution is on. And renewable energy can be really the centerpiece of jobs and building a culture. Let's talk a little bit more about the solar possibilities just in Cully as an example. You have that big industrial area. There's a lot of ruined land there and a lot of parking areas and a lot of storage things. Have you been thinking about somehow getting very large supply of panels? I mean, a big panel farm right on that highway there. It seems to me it's quite possible.
Yeah, one of the projects that we identified in our energy plan was actually a community solar project, hopefully located within the neighborhood so that people would be able to see, you know, a large solar array within the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. The challenge being that it is an urban space. You know, we would have to find a pretty large, either open, empty lot or partner with some type of large, like, industrial partner or possibly, like, someone else within the neighborhood that has a large rooftop capacity so that we could build, you know, a solar farm big enough that would support multiple families. And I want to say that I agree that I do think that, you know, there's so much opportunity in solar, but it's really inaccessible right now for low-income families for so many different reasons. One being just the upfront cost at the moment, like putting solar panels on your roof can cost anywhere between like $8,000 and $15,000.
Or more.
And people don't have that type of money. Also, we have a large percentage of renters in the neighborhood, so they don't have ownership over their roofs. And we have a lot of low-income homeowners that before solar, they need, you know, weatherization, they need new roofs, new windows. And so there's so much opportunity with solar, but it's really inaccessible at this time.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick here with two guests from Verde, a wonderful organization in Cully that is attempting to really reconstruct Cully and keep the people there, build a beautiful neighborhood and end displacement. Part of major part of it is environmental sustainability and the jobs it creates. Let's talk about how important renewable energy is now. And Carolina discussed the plans that need money, but why is it so important now to move towards small-scale renewable energy, not huge grids, not huge solar farms in New Mexico serving the whole region or in Arizona? All of that is extremely expensive and extremely time-consuming to build and extremely vulnerable to breakdowns. Community energy is a whole nother matter. Why don't we talk about that just for a minute or two even?
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people are very aware of climate change, what's happening globally, and how our current energy system, you know, is dependent on fossil fuels. And if we really want to begin to make a difference, we need to look at alternative energies. And so renewable energy and solar is one opportunity. I think people are excited about solar just because you can build it on a smaller scale. And so it's more accessible for individual households and businesses and communities. And so I think one, just like the opportunity to begin investing in technology that actually helps our environment rather than depleting our environment is one great benefit. Another one is just that our energy infrastructure, the grid, is old and it needs to be reinvested in. Pieces of it need to be rebuilt. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity right now to talk about how the grid is going to be modernized and what benefits we want to see out of those investment projects. There's also like a lot of opportunity right now to begin looking at, you know, if it's possible, like what smaller grids might look like, how we're able to actually generate energy ourselves to supply to the grid. I think
instead of building huge grids, huge high volume grids, mm-hmm. which lose electricity all the way, it's very they lose a tremendous amount of electricity when you're running 100 or 300 or 1,000 miles these lines. Microgrids, small grids will be really resilient mm-hmm. and cheap to build and by ordinary people. You don't have to go to the huge construction companies.
Yeah. And I would say that, like, you know, one of the reasons that we have like this monopoly system is because it's supposedly cheaper to build at a really large scale. It's supposedly cheaper for producing energy. But what we've seen here in the Cully neighborhood is that for low-income households, you know, using electricity isn't cheaper, like with the current system. We talk a lot about energy burden. I think there's an energy crisis among low-income households where they're paying a lot out of pocket to heat their homes. And with climate change, we're beginning to see hotter summers. And so there's also
cooling.
Cooling is going to become a very important need. And so renewable energy, our goal and our vision is how do we make sure that our communities, low-income communities, can build this infrastructure so that they can bring down their energy costs. And it really is cheaper for all families, all households, and not just more affluent households.
Yeah, I'd share two quick points for your listeners. One is that the number one reason for payday loans is utility bills. And to me, that is a shameful thing in our society that in order to heat your home, keep your family warm or keep your family cool, that you have to advance your payday, your paycheck to be able to cover that. We need to stop that. The second piece, though, is that we are very fortunate here in Portland and in Multnomah County to have passed 100% renewable resolutions that set us on a pathway to 100% renewable energy consumed in the city of Portland and Multnomah County by 2035. And more importantly for our efforts is we were able to create 2% of that energy to come from community-owned sources. That's about $1 billion worth of energy. So we have roughly 17 years to start building that infrastructure, and that takes money. And so that brings me back to the Portland Clean Energy Fund, where we need to really accelerate both the adoption of these, but also the economic benefits of these into low-income people's pockets.
You know, there's one last thing, folks, that I wanted to talk about that we're going to have to do at another time, which is discussing what you call social enterprises. I've always thought that the model we really should be promoting is worker ownership and worker control through cooperatives. But your social enterprises, actually, some of them would be cooperatives and some of them would be more ordinary kind of nonprofit forms, but with a whole lot more worker involvement, decent pay and benefits. Why don't you talk about that for a minute, Tony?
Sure.
I might not be able to.
No, it's exciting, and we'd be real honored to come back and share with you more about that. Social enterprises are businesses that operate underneath of the nonprofit entity. So we have two right now, Verde Builds, which is a general contractor and is building the solar array on top of St. Charles Church. and Verde Landscape, which is a commercial landscaper that does stormwater and tree planting and other ways of reducing stormwater into our system. They're not worker-owned cooperatives, but they are heavily investing in low-income people through training programs that are designed and tailored to fit the needs of individuals coming into the programs, and they produce these broader social benefits and environmental benefits. So we'd love to talk more about that in the future.
Going back to the Portland Clean Energy Fund, we definitely recognize that we want our communities, communities of color here in Portland, low-income communities, to be able to participate in these new and emerging technologies, which currently aren't accessible unless you have the money. And so we have the vision, we have the ideas, and now what we need is the funding stream. And so the Portland Clean Energy Fund creates that funding mechanism so that we can access solar, we can access energy efficiency technologies, we can access the jobs and bring that to our neighborhoods.
It's a really wonderful vision, but of course it requires money, and the PCEF, the Portland Clean Energy Fund, will offer, if it passes and the initiative gets on the ballot and it passes, and that's not guaranteed.
That's a good point. So that's why we really need folks to come out and help. And, you know, for cable listeners out there, I really urge you to get involved in the campaign. Go to portlandcleanenergyfund.com. You'll see there events and upcoming opportunities that you can get trained to gather signatures. You can donate. You can come out to hear about the proposals. And it is going to take all of us because, you know, this is both an innovative idea to create this new source of funding for renewable energy and energy efficiency that prioritizes the needs of low-income people and people of color and brings together environmental groups and community of color-serving organizations and creates a sustainable source of funding that nonprofits can access to build this infrastructure, to create jobs, to create job training opportunities. But it's going to take all of us to win, you know, because, you know, this 25 other cities out there are ready to replicate this if we can win here. And that makes the larger corporations nervous. And so, you know, this is a chance right now here in May and June to come together to say, hey, yes, we want this positive future. And in November then to say yes again, to say yes to something that moves us forward out of this dark, you know, past of coal production that has harmed our communities to a place where instead our communities are in charge. We're benefiting from the energy production, and it's making us more resilient over time.
Tony DeFalco and Carolina Arata, thanks a lot for talking to us today. It was wonderful.
Thanks, Bill, for having us.
This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mill Variety Hour. Now Clayton Mortgage is here with a commentary he calls Civilization and Our Discontents. In it, he shows that the glories of civilization have always required the coerced labor of the forgotten masses. And the same is true of the comforts of modern life. They are manufactured by the poor for the enjoyment of the affluent. Clayton?
Freud's last book, and possibly his most famous, is Civilization and Its Discontents. In it, he discusses the sacrifices of enjoyment that are required to participate in civilized life and the stress of having to behave ourselves. Both our violent and our sexual impulses have to be inhibited and reorganized. But I want to turn to another kind of discontent, the generations of forced labor over several thousand years, including today, that make civilizations possible. The achievements of civilization are indeed remarkable, and they go back at least as far as to ancient Mesopotamia, Persia, Egypt, China, Greece, and Rome. There were, of course, magnificent civilizations in the Americas, but these were largely destroyed by European invaders before they were able to teach us much. But the others created and bequeathed to us developments in the arts, including architecture, painting, sculpture, and literature, as well as the foundations of the sciences, technology, philosophy, and religion, and of course, of the languages we speak today, the number system that made possible modern mathematics, science, and technology. Our modern world, with its comforts, the protection and insulation from heat and cold, our instantaneous and global access to information, entertainment, literature, and the arts, food and drink from almost anywhere, and the ability to bring an infinite variety of consumer goods to our doorsteps merely by pressing a few buttons on a keyboard, all this is but the latest chapter in the story of civilization. Let's not forget, though, that what I have called civilizations are also empires, militarized power structures that gather the wealth from a large and expanding area and concentrate its control and enjoyment in the homeland, in Athens, Rome, or London, say. Empires come by conquest, by the force of invading armies, followed by officials empowered to enact taxes and tribute from local populations. But it was not just goods and raw materials that were expropriated from the lands and peoples of empire. It was also the people themselves, brought back to the center as slaves to do most of the unskilled and some of the skilled labor that constructed the magnificent edifices we can still visit today. Slaves labored in the fields and mines and workshops. Domestic slaves prepared food, took care of children, cleaned the floors and clothing. The elites were thus free to organize military campaigns, participate in councils of government, manage religious practices, plan cities, design buildings, and to read and write and discuss works of philosophy, political theory, science, and literature. In the U.S., we are still living in the empire that began with Columbus and the English colonization of Virginia and New England. The Europeans who first arrived certainly could not create civilization or extract much wealth by their own labor alone, nor did they ever intend to. They were counting on the natives of the new land to join the civilized world and work for their white masters. Columbus sent 4 shiploads of native Caribbeans back to for sale in Mediterranean slave markets. The English in North America, finding natives difficult to enslave, imported poor English, Scots, and Irish as indentured servants. But that servitude was temporary, and there were not enough of them to work the enormous land that was available as natives were displaced by war and disease. So they began importing enslaved people from the West Indies and Africa, thanks to the enterprising slave traders of Portugal and Spain. To make a long story short, over the next 3 centuries, the number of enslaved black people who planted, cultivated, harvested, and processed tobacco, sugar, and cotton in the southern United States grew to 4 million enslaved people, while the proceeds of those crops exported to the north and to England created and multiplied the wealth of European and American bankers and merchants, as well as that of southern plantation owners. That rapid accumulation of wealth resulting from the brutally coerced labor of the enslaved built the financial and industrial foundation of the American empire that spanned the continent and was soon exploiting and expropriating the resources and labor of people in the Caribbean, Latin America, and the Pacific. Just as the highly cultured lives of Greeks and Romans, to whom our culture owes so much, would not have been possible without their colonies and slaves, neither would the civilized lives told of in the novels of Jane Austen or in the TV series Downton Abbey have been conceivable without the British Empire and the fortunes made by British investors from slave-grown cotton. The money investors made from the business of slaves and cotton enabled the rapid industrialization of the U.S. after the Civil War and the rise of this country as a great power. The amenities of modern life in the developed world continue to be produced by people who work barely to survive and who have little, if any, access to those amenities themselves. Our food is largely grown, harvested, packaged, and often prepared and served by people, many of them people of color, in low-wage, insecure jobs. Our clothing, appliances, and electrical gear are assembled by workers in China and other places where workers are paid less than $1 an hour to solder, assemble, and package products for the world's best-known brands. Our houses and apartment and office buildings are mostly built and maintained by poorly paid immigrant workers. Our children are often cared for and even educated by people who must struggle every day to make their costs of living. Civilization has produced wonderful things that could, if they were managed in the common interests of everyone, provide a good life for all of us. The history of empire, slavery, and capitalism is the story of a process that has coerced and conned the vast majority of humanity to labor to provide the fortunate, well-born few with the advantages of civilization. It's time to turn the tables, to take control of the wealth we have created and put it and ourselves to work cooperatively to build the world that all that wealth can make possible. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Clayton. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next, Field Mole Desiree Helliger spoke with canoe families and kayaktivists who were in Seattle on May 20 for an Indigenous-led day of resistance to Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, which would carry oil from Alberta tar sands to tankers in the port of Burnaby, British Columbia, just outside Vancouver. Desiree?
Curtis Dengler, you're with Mosquito Fleet?
That's right. That's right, that's me.
Yeah, tell me about today's action.
Absolutely. So today, we're essentially here to show not only Washington, but the world that this pipeline, Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, is not just a Canadian fight, but it is a regional fight, and it's also a global fight over the stability of our global climate. But primarily, we're here to talk about the impacts on local waters and local communities. A lot of folks don't know that if this pipeline is built, the oil tanker traffic in the Salish Sea, Washington and Canadian waters included, would increase by 700%, something around 400 additional tankers per year, I believe. And these things are carrying heavy tar sands crude, which is extremely toxic and impossible to clean up because it sinks straight to the bottom. They're not only putting this product on tankers throughout U.S. waters, but we also have oil barges, which are largely unregulated. They're not required under Washington law yet to have tug escorts and full safety crews as oil tankers are. So essentially, we're here to say that Kinder Morgan's operations in our region already are unacceptably dangerous. So the last thing that we need is to make things 700% worse. And today is really about not only highlighting those local impacts, but most importantly, showing that this resistance has no borders and is regional and global, and we're coming together as one Salish Sea. We have folks coming down from British Columbia who are representing the struggle up north. We've been sending activists to support the struggles up north of the colonial border as well. And we're trying to come here as a united front to say that we won't put up with this project. It will not be built on our watch, and we'll do everything in our power to stop it. And that goes beyond just symbolic action, but to nonviolent direct action. Earlier this week, the Mosquito Fleet was out on the water at Kinder Morgan's terminal on Tuesday, and we blockaded the terminal and blockaded an oil barge shipment with climbers and kayakers. And, here to say that we're just getting started. And if Kinder Morgan continues to pursue this project, they will continue to see growing resistance throughout the region.
Thank you so much, Curtis.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Carl Wassily.
And Carl, your life has really revolved around the fossil fuel fight for some time now. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I was born in Fairbanks, Alaska, went K-12 in Seward, Alaska, which is 1,000 miles down the coast from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So as a teenager, I became very aware of the lies of these companies. Some of the same investors that are right here at Kinder Morgan are part of the Exxon mobile investments in transportation infrastructure. And that's where most of the accidents occur and catastrophes, but it's industrial fossil fuel companies, usually along the transportation corridors, that cause the most damage, and usually the highest risk areas are the ones where that are most remote that tend to have the most biodiversity and wildlife too. So I'm happy to be here today.
And you're a biologist.
I'm a biologist, Yupik biologist. I'm here on the Salish Sea, and salmon person. So anything that affects the salmon is a big issue for us. In Alaska, these pipelines would come through about, we'd have some super tankers in the Bering Sea. We've lost vessels in the Bering Sea before. Simple things like even lack of regulation and oversight in the northern Bering, in the northern Pacific and Bering Sea, allowed the companies to run with secondary equipment. So, yeah, once they get out of the Salish Sea, I think it just even gets riskier with these companies. They're trying to cut back on transportation costs and make more money, and leaving us communities in Alaska at risk too.
Yeah, and you've been here for other actions as well.
Yeah,
Polar Pioneer.
Yeah, the Shell No action here. Occupied a barge right a couple hundred yards offshore here, and kept an eye on the drilling rig that barely made it up to Alaska and tried to sink its teeth into the Arctic Ocean, but ran out of time and ran out of ice and ran out of finances, and they had to cut their losses, and Shell backed out. Thanks to a lot of folks in the Pacific Northwest keeping the pressure on and slowing them down. So that's what we're going to do with Kinder Morgan.
All right. Thank you so much, Carl.
Thank you.
My name is Rebecca Kinley. I serve as a youth leadership manager and the social marketing coordinator for the Lummi Nation. I operate and manage the Lummi Youth Canoe Family. We had the honor and privilege of doing similar protests around issues that are meaningful, and they, impact our Stillingan, our way of life. The kids in 2014 came down here and did that. The Shell No protest, yeah, and that's where they first started getting interested in all the environmental impacts, especially since it was really a hit home because a lot of our families live off the water and they're gatherers. And a lot of the things that the corporate people are doing to make money is impacting the many, many families that we serve. Working with these youth now for over 8 years, the one thing that they've always told me is they've always wanted to create a legacy so when they have children that they were making decisions today that were going to impact their lifestyles. And I think that's a lot how our tribal leaders and our ancestors fought for what we have today. And we have to continue that movement.
The Terry Point victory was just phenomenal.
It was. Especially, I think that's irritating knowing that we won that Terry Point terminal case. And now they want to propose putting the Kinder Morgan pipeline to the same area, which, do they really think they're going to win? I think Lummi brings strong unity of other tribes, but not just Lummi, in partnership with, Stalo, Tsleil-Waututh, Tulalip. Impacts all of us, not just one or two people.
Yeah, so you could be looking at, massive tanker traffic, oil slicks, oil spills.
Oh, yeah, no, exactly. And then what it would do is it would totally destroy our way of life, and then we'd have to recreate and redefine who we are, and that's just not something I think we want to do or we're willing to do.
How many people are going to be out on the canoe?
We'll probably have 12. Mainly youth. I think that would be two adults.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Definitely. Thank you.
My name is Howie Chong. I'm a campaigner with Stand.Earth, and I'm based out of Vancouver. In Vancouver, there is a massive mobilization against the Kinder Morgan pipeline. It's being led primarily by Coast Salish leaders from nations such as Tsleil-Waututh and Squamish. And a lot of people, settlers and immigrants alike, are following this indigenous-led opposition to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. Here today to bear witness to what's happening here today, to know that there is a lot of solidarity on both sides of the colonial border between Canada and the United States. We need to stop this for multiple reasons. It is it's dangerous to the Salish Sea. It has no indigenous consent in this part of the world. And it's just deathly for the climate and for orcas and the salmon who are here as well. So, I know the stats from places like Vancouver. If Kinder Morgan ends up building this pipeline that currently terminates in Burnaby, which is a suburb of Vancouver, the amount of oil tankers up and down the Salish Sea is going to increase about 700%. So that's a sevenfold increase. Right now, there is about one tanker a day that goes into the Westridge Terminal for Kinder Morgan. Just outside there and suburban Vancouver, if they were to end up building this pipeline, it would be more than one a day. So if it would go from one a week to one a day, to more than one a day, so about 400 per year. These are what are known as Aframax tankers. So they are tankers that are that's the max size that you can use to go through the Suez Canal. And so that's the size, it's the maximum size it can put there because of the limited amount of maneuverability that exists in the Burrard Inlet in Vancouver Harbor. And so that's one of the dangers as well. In the past, in the 1970s, there was actually a barge that hit one of the rail bridges. That's how narrow some of these passages are. And they want to increase now the number of these massive Aframax tankers from one a week to one a day. And it's a huge problem. The city of Vancouver has done studies, and they've said that if this pipeline were to go through, there would be about an 87% chance of a massive spill in the lifetime of the pipeline. And that risks an enormous amount of not just like our natural environment, but of all the jobs that are reliant on such a clean environment. So that goes everything from tourism to fishing. There's a vibrant film community in Vancouver. There's all these different things that would be threatened, and all these like tens and hundreds of thousands of jobs threatened for a small handful of permanent jobs that this pipeline would bring. And so that's why there's so much opposition. This pipeline is doesn't actually benefit anybody on the coast, and only risks those on the coast. And those on the coast don't get any of the benefit and just have to deal with all of risk. And that's why I think a lot of people are here today, and that's why I'm here today as well.
And that's even apart from just the carbon impacts if it's actually transported and burned.
Yeah, that's right. I come to this fight primarily from the climate change world. I've spent about 15 years trying to fight climate change, and it would be an enormous impact. We are trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. But if they end up building this pipeline, all you're doing is locking our economy into a fossil fuel future when we should be doing the opposite. We should be actually moving off of it. Prime Minister Trudeau in Canada has been saying that, you know, you have to, quote unquote, balance the environment and the economy. But he's saying that in a way that really overemphasizes the economic impact of and only the economic benefit of this pipeline rather than all the economic risks that this pipeline would bring as well. The Trudeau government has actually said last week that they're willing to indemnify Kinder Morgan or any other company that decides to build this pipeline, meaning that the federal government in Canada and Justin Trudeau's government is willing to put in public money, public taxpayer dollars, to bail out Kinder Morgan if there are continued delays. He's willing to use Canadian taxpayer money to build a pipeline that does not have consent of over 150 First Nations. It does not have consent from over 150 First Nations. It does not have the consent from dozens of municipalities in British Columbia. And it doesn't have the consent of the people here or people in Vancouver as well.
Kai Sanborn, I live in Lopez Island in the San Juans, and I'm here because I think that the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline represents a radical risk to the increased risk to the Salish Sea, and it also is to transport tar sands oil, which is dirty, costly, and as far as I can tell, a kind of criminal treatment of the earth. Tar sands extraction and fracking are examples of an end-stage addiction. It's like a junkie can kind of manage their addiction for a certain period of time pretty well. But pretty soon the drug takes over and they start getting more and more radical. They start shooting up using dirty needles and then end up with all kinds of harms. And I really see that in tar sands oil and fracking. So that's why I'm here.
Katie McFadden, Portland, Oregon. I have my own studio, local artist, ceramic artist, printmaker, and teach at Clackamas Community College. I've been involved with political activism my whole life, but most recently with kayaktivism.
You're in your 70s?
72.
You were on the water during the Seneca action.
I was. And detained by the Coast Guard and released, catch and release. No charges against me.
You're a pretty big fish.
I'm a big fish. And a number of people have asked me why kayaktivism, that particular format. And I just feel like it is probably one of the most poetic ways of opposing these tiny little boats standing up against the mega business, mega shipping industries. So It's time that we all came together and said we need to change the way that we live and how we relate to this planet. I got wind of it by going to a movie on the valve turner. These are the people that really came forward, knowing full well that they were going to have serious charges against them. Ken Ward has said that there are times that laws are not necessarily in the interest of people and the planet at large, and this was a case in which he felt morally compelled to do what he could. Admirable. Heroes of the day.
So what are you looking forward to today?
Joining with people and having our voices heard that we need to rethink how we are living on this planet. The planet will get rid of us if we don't.
Thank you, Katie.
You're welcome.
We all are students at the University of Washington.
We're graduate students in atmospheric science at the University of Washington.
All right. Have you done co-activism before? Or?
I've done some activism and I've done some kayaking, but never at the same time. So I think it's a really good way to demonstrate, and I'm pretty excited. So
yeah, what do you like it as a form of demonstration?
I don't know. I think it really shows the amount of commitment and effort that people are willing to put into this cause. The fact that there's all these kayaks here and all these people have come together to do this.
Been listening to the voices from canoe families and kayaktivists who gathered last Sunday, May 20th in Seattle to protect the Salish Sea and demonstrate their resistance to the proposed Kinder Morgan pipeline. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Special thanks to Carl Wassily for his help with this segment. Thanks, Carl. And the last word goes to an activist with the canoe families.
What do you want to say to Portland about KM?
About Kinder Morgan? Fight. Fight. All day, all night. We can't be this way. This is climate disaster. We have to.
Thank you.
Yahow. Tell them Yahow.
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 Yahow means to complete something together that it can only be done together. People have to Yahow.
This is KBOO Portland, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are all familiar with the notion that capitalism is a form of slavery, wage slavery. Today I'm going to share an article which takes a contingent but slightly different tack. Although the author doesn't use the term, I will call it time slavery. If you're not familiar with the theory of an original affluent society, it's a theory that claims that pre-agricultural hunter-gatherer societies, in the main, were able to satisfy all their needs very efficiently and in a timely manner that left plenty of time for leisure and recreation. This theory was first articulated by Marshall Sahlins at a symposium entitled Man the Hunter in 1966. In 1999, Jaron Diamond, the well-known author of Gun, Germs, and Steel, published an article entitled The Worst Mistake in the History of the Human Race. Diamond was tacitly supporting Sahlins' theory of the original affluent society and argued that the transition from a roaming hunter-gatherer mode of existence to a settled agricultural one was a catastrophe from which we have yet to recover. Initially, agriculture and animal husbandry appeared to be of great benefit in creating an abundance of food. But this immediately led to a population explosion, and soon farmers and herdmen were toiling night and day trying to stave off starvation. And we've been toiling and sweating ever since. The other physical and social negative effects of this transition are too numerous to deal with here, but indicative of those effects on our health, skeletons from Greece and Turkey show that the average height of hunter-gatherers toward the end of the Ice Ages was 5'9" for men, 5'5" for women. With the adoption of agriculture, height crashed, and by 3000 BC had reached a low of only 5'3" for men and 5' for women. On the societal level, it marked, of course, the beginning of class differentiation and class struggle. The article I'm going to read today is entitled The Need to Work Less is a Matter of Life and Death, with a subtitle, Work Dominates Many of Our Lives, Often in Ways That Are Detrimental to Our Health and Well-Being. The article was written by David Spencer and argues that time slavery has reached an apex under present-day late capitalism. The recent May 1st holiday, he begins, that is acknowledged by most of the industrialized world, but not here in the U.S., is intimately linked to labor history and its struggles over time spent at work. In the U.S., May Day has its origins in the fight for an 8-hour workday at the end of the 19th century. This fight was and remains a quest for a broader ideal, namely the achievement of a life beyond work. Yet we are stuck by the lack of progress towards this ideal. Work is not diminished in society. Rather, it has continued to dominate our lives, often as ways that are detrimental to our health and well-being. Many U.S. workers have found themselves working more than eight-hour days. A dream of working less promoted by their forebears has turned into a nightmare of long hours of work for no extra pay. The irony, of course, is that capitalism was supposed to offer something different. It was meant to offer a life of more leisure and free time. Technology was supposed to advance in ways that would bring holidays every month, possibly every week. Luminaries like economist John Maynard Keynes dreamt of a 15-hour work week by 2030. Yet capitalism has produced the exact opposite. Its effect has been to preserve and extend work. It has also created problems in the content and meaning of work. The circumstances are such that rather than idle away and enjoy our time off on holidays, we are likely to spend it exhausted, stressed, and annoyed about a world that is less than what it can be. Work is not working. High numbers of workers are prepared to work while on holiday. Work, it seems, extends to time when workers are neither paid nor physically at work. One reason for this behavior is a pervasive work ethic. The idea of work remains strong and prevents any hint of slacking off. The work ethic can reflect, in the case of some middle-class jobs, high intrinsic rewards, but it also reflects on societal norms and imperatives that privilege and sanctify work. Needless to say, these norms and imperatives suit the material interests of employers. Another reason for workers committing to work is the pressure of financial necessity. Stagnant and falling real wages mean workers have to keep working in order to live. Keynes' dream of a 15-hour work week by 2030 assumed benevolent employers passing on the productivity gains made from technology in the form of shorter work hours. It did not contemplate a world where employers would pocket the gains for themselves at the expense of more work for workers. The demand of employers that we work more has been intensified by changes in technology that have bound us to work. Smartphones mean instant access to email and offer a constant connection to work. Being on call when not at work is part of the modern work culture. There's also a direct power aspect in the sense that work is now often precarious and insecure. People dare not show a lack of commitment for fear of losing their jobs. How better to show commitment than to attend work while ill and work during holidays? Yet all the evidence is that long hours are bad for health and ultimately productivity. Workers working long hours are more likely to have a heart attack, suffer a stroke, and experience depression. Coming to work ill is also likely to make you feel more ill and could make others around you ill. Recent research from the U.S. suggests that toxic workplaces, excessive hours, stressful work regimes, are a public health hazard. These workplaces have been shown to shorten lives. They are literally killing workers. The alternative is for employers to reorganize work. Evidence suggests shorter work hours can boost health and productivity, providing a potential win-win outcome for employers and workers. Given such evidence, why do employers keep pushing workers to work more? The simple answer relates to the capitalist system itself. The imperative for profit translates into a drive to work more. Technology, for similar reasons, becomes a tool for control and for pumping out more work. While employers may benefit from less work, they work within a system that prevents this goal. Working less is inimical to a system where profit matters more than the pursuit of well-being in and beyond work. Deaths through overwork are a necessary byproduct. If we want a better future, we need to continue the collective struggle for less work. Our lives may depend upon it. That was an article entitled "The Need to Work Less is a Matter of Life and Death" by David Spencer, professor of economics and political economy at the University of Leeds. This article was originally published on the Conversation webpage.
If dogs run free, why not we? Across the swooping plain. My ears hear a symphony of two mules, trains, and rain. The best is always yet to come. That's what they explain to me. Just do your thing, you'll be king. If dogs run free. Ooh, yeah. dogs run free. Why not me? Across the swamp of time. My mind weaves a symphony and tapestry of rhyme. Oh, winds which rush my tail to thee, so it may flow and be. To each his own, it's all unknown. If dogs run free.
That was Bob Dylan, If Dogs Run Free. The song is obviously protesting against our regimented and routinized lives. Since the song came out in 1970, things have not gone well. Nowadays, dogs no longer run free either. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Mole, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmentalism. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics as well as past programs.